please dial star 611 for assistance.
We get signal, main screen turn on. You're listening to the radio program about hackerspaces. This here little radio program about hackerspaces. Yeah, welcome to Talking Anthropology. Today we have the 19th of January 2011, and I want to put a focus today onto the Arabic world, and therefore I have with me today Basil Safadi. Hello.
Hi.
Maybe you introduce yourself and tell the audience something about you, what you do and where you come from.
Well, I run a hackerspace in Syria called IK Lab, and it basically focuses on software side, on open source software, and trying to get the making culture into the Arab world. I also work with Creative Commons in Syria and many other Arab world countries, and run a company, open source company called IK Framework in Singapore. And work with the Fabricators is another open source company that develops projects under Creative Commons and GPL license.
Mm-hmm. And how long are you into technology and into open source?
I've been doing this for 8 years so far. Basically 8 years. Yeah.
What was your starting point? At which age did you get involved? For
I get involved when at the age of 20, and my first involvement was in Fedora system, like probably it was version 1 or 2.
Mm-hmm.
And when Fedora project started to make those big steps, like in version 2 or 3, like was really excited to get involved. So I started in translation projects, and then started some kernel modules, like local kernel module developing, but never succeeded to push any of my changes to Fedora repositories. And then we're more interested in the web technologies, so I started writing a framework for developing website content management systems, and in like 5 years it became a product. It's now IK Framework.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So we'll come to IK Framework later, because I find it quite interesting. But I also started with Fedora. That was my first Linux distribution. And but much later than you did, just because of my age. But we have someone else who originally we planned to have in this discussion. It's John Phillips. Maybe he will join us later. You just told me that he is right now at the Transmediale in Berlin and speaking right now there. But maybe you can tell us something about him, about your colleague.
I met with John in Fedora's IRC channel like 6 years earlier. And he used work for Creative Commons international relationship management and business development at that time, and we started together a project called OpenClipArt. It's a public domain repository for SVG files, and then he worked with StatusNet for a while, the Identica project, the open source Twitter. I wouldn't call it knockoff, but it's a Twitter alternative. It's
It's status.net, which is based on this decentralized alternative to Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think many people know it. It's not that popular as Twitter is, but it basically fulfills the same purpose and is a decentralized version of it. So,
There are many good aspects of using decentralized servers. But if you want, like in the airport, like. Or, like, let's say Iran, mm-hmm. Twitter was blocked, and like most Iranian activists were using Identica or SatSnet alternatives because the government can't block it in Iran, right? Because it's decentralized, you can put any domain anytime and just connect all the SatSnet installations, right? So, if you have like 3 websites, you can connect them and like make them appear in one site and then change that later.
Mm-hmm. I just see John coming online. Okay.
Yo. Hey.
Hi.
Hey.
Hello.
Hi.
Ah, great to have you with us. Good. We had just 5 minutes of chatting before you arrived. And
sure.
John, it's good to have you with us. Finally you made it.
Great.
It's good that you're here because Basil was just about to give an introduction about you. And maybe you can do this now yourself. Tell us something about you.
Sure. So my name is Jason Phillips. And Basil and I work together on several different projects, one being Fabricators, which is a crew of different people from around the world working on open production and free software, but as a business. And then one of our projects is IQ Lab, and it kind of comes out of a software we built called IQ Framework, and the name IQ does, which means joining spirits in Japanese. And one of the projects that we talked about doing and Basil spearheaded was the IQLab.org, which is a cultural center / hackerspace in Damascus. And we've been working together on this for about a year. And beyond that, we've been working together for a few years as well.
Mm. Yeah, Basil just told me about his early work in translating material out of the open source community into Arabic. Maybe we can start talking about this. What was the situation in the Arabic world when it comes to open source? How widely is it spread or used by the people?
Well, at the time I started open source, using open source in Syria, I didn't have like the general knowledge of the status of open source in the whole Arab world. But I can talk about Syria specifically like 10 years earlier. The problem with open source was the high rate of piracy. So where you can like buy, and it still exists, where you can buy any software for $1.
Mm-hmm.
And so people were thinking, like, why should we use open source in the first place if we can buy Windows or Mac applications, like, for $1?
Mm-hmm.
And there was, like, a movement, like, about, like, 50 people were introducing the concept of open source and community-based project. And I love to join them into the translation project. And it's from that point, it started to involve more people. And now there are like thousands of people using open source systems like Ubuntu, Fedora, and open source like audio editing. I have a friend of me, he's DJ, and he uses Audacity for editing. But still, the number of people involved directly in the open source industry, like people who write open source products, are like the number of those people are really small, and most of them involved only in the web technologies, like building websites using Drupal or building Drupal plugins or mm-hmm. add-ons. So it's really like it's starting now, but it's not spread like really well.
Mm-hmm. And is it used from official side for education or inside governments? Do you know anything about that?
No, it's not used inside the government. The government uses Microsoft products. Mm-hmm. They have. It's funny though because the embargo stuff. You can't buy like Microsoft products, but the government is using pirated versions of Windows and other products, and they say that they talk about that and like don't hide it because of the embargo. Also, like big companies in Syria and Saudi Arabia, like I don't want to give names, but they use like pirated versions of Oracle databases, and they say that they admit it. So. The implementation is still small in the like enterprise sector or government sector.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to other media like movies or music, how is it then with copyright issues? Is there any awareness or any feeling of guilt, or is it Wild West and you can nearly do what you want, basically?
Yeah, basically that's correct. You can do whatever you want. For some products like Avid products, let's say, like media companies used to buy the whole like video editing sets. Like there's one called Adrenaline, and it's really famous in their board where they buy the whole set with the software installed on it. But outside of those kind of setups, people will just like, yeah, let's use After Effects, like download it from Torrent or buy it for a dollar from the market. I mean, that's in Syria. I can't talk about the other countries. It's probably the copyright awareness is much better in Jordan and Lebanon, the Gulf area, especially like 3 years from now, it started to become like an issue and people started to. Like, for example, in Dubai, there's no piracy and everyone keeps, has to buy the original software. Mm.
John, maybe you can tell us how you came to Syria. What's your story with this country?
So I came to Syria through Basel. And we've been working on free software projects from Open Clipart Library, which is a large clipart collection, and some other different types of activities, some Creative Commons in particular. So we actually physically met because of an accidental email, and I accidentally CC'd him and another person because I was working at Creative Commons. I was in charge of business development and community for a few years. And from there, Basil and our other friend Donatella became friends and started talking about Creative Commons in the region and how to make that better. So since then, we just kept doing different projects, and I've been to Syria a couple times and anxious to do some more and more projects in the region. I like to think of it as an important place in the Middle East, but also as a coming from the U.S., it's also interesting culturally, and it's also interesting because Basil's one of my best friends, so it's fun to work on projects together.
And then you two started the first hackerspace in Syria. Maybe you can tell us something about the motivation you had at the time and the preconditions you found. I mean, how did you come up with the idea of building a hackerspace in Syria?
I've been in Singapore like 6 months before I started the hackerspace, and there is a hackerspace in Singapore which was like really cool to me at that point. And I was thinking like, how can we introduce the making culture into the Arab world? Because there's like a huge consumption culture, but like nobody wants to make anything. Like there are people, but how can we connect with them? Like how can we know them? So I was looking with John to fund the Blaze, and then we found a Dutch fund, and it kickstarted because of that.
And what about the preconditions? What was the image of a hacker in Syria? Because
people still mix between hackers, like the good people who make stuff, and the hackers or crackers, the people who like hack websites and other stuff. And because of this, I get in trouble many times trying to explain this to the government agencies. And then I had to change the name from, like, I removed all the hackerspace signs from inside the hackerspace and now called IKLab. It's a cultural center. So the word hacker is tricky to use for most people because...
Yeah, that's...
This is John. Mm-hmm. I mean, also the hackerspace term is kind of hard to use, not just in Syria, but other places as well. We do some work with China, and even in China, the word has a different kind of connotation. So it's important to understand that and also what it means longer term. And I mean, just because it's a kind of a trendy word to use, really it's more about the activity, the type of activity that happens inside the space, this type of like we say in Syria, like cultural work. There's the type of get-togethers, and like maybe someone comes through town who's an important figure in free software or in development, and have them talk to people directly and come together.
The problem is quite universal. I mean, at hackerspaces.org, we get many requests from people who want to fund their space, and we often have resemblances about the word hacker because it still is not that easy to explain what it really means to government officials or the general public. And yeah, we know this problem well, and I just wanted to ask what strategies you had. So you went for the cultural making part, but you didn't call yourself a makerspace. Because you wanted to focus more on software, or because there were some implications to go for culture?
Well, when we started, we were trying to focus on the making side and the open source software. And then earlier we found like it's much better to focus on the culture side of openness and creation. Like we had few events where we theoretically speak about open source, because we found that we need to work more on the people side before starting doing some practical projects at this point, because the culture, the making culture and the open licensing culture was not introduced the right way in Syria. So that's why we focused on the culture and theoretical part in the first 8 months of the work.
Speaking about licenses, Basil, maybe you can tell us something about the Arabic version of the Creative Commons license and your involvement in that.
Yeah, Arabic version, the translation project of the Arabic version started like 5 years earlier by Jordanian team. And then an Egyptian team also started another translation project. And we had a problem with the number of people helping on the lawyer side and the community side. So a lot of people had to put big efforts to make this happen. And until now, there is no official Arabic translation Creative Commons license, but there was a great announcement from the Egyptian team that the first one will be started at the end of this month, will be officially launched.
Wow.
Yeah, in Syria we just help them launch the licenses. We don't do our own version of the license in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Would it be necessary to make a localization for your own country are the copyright laws so much different between Egypt and Syria?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but lawyers always say that there are differences that need to be. So that's why there need to be different licenses. But I do support that to have one Arabic license to make it like more usable for and more friendly for normal users. But lawyers think, yeah, we have to have another license.
But also, this is John here. So in terms of Creative Commons licenses. There's different kind of interpretations of Creative Commons licenses, and again, we're both not lawyers. It's kind of a thing you have to always say, talk about anything legal in Creative Commons land. Yeah. But basically, Creative Commons licenses have port in several countries, but may say that even without that, the unported Creative Commons license is just as effective. So. Even getting people in to have an expression or some type of reading of the Creative Commons unported license is just as valid.
Maybe we come to the IKEA framework. This project you are involved into, which is Basilis. And as far as I understood it, it is something like a LAMP, Linux Apache MySQL PHP wrapper, which is a kind of fail-safe mechanism or security mechanism, but maybe you can clear that up, what it is and what it does.
IKEA framework is a collaborative development tool, right? Because like all the main problem with most of the open source projects is that people cannot contribute to the software of the website or to the project easily because they have to use SVN or all those hacky like nerdy tools to submit their tools and their submissions. It's totally fine to use this approach, but we thought we can make it easier by building a simple interface, an online interface, where people, for example, can register in a project. Let's say I want to support, like, I'm a user of OpenClipArt and I think I can contribute to the website. So I can register as a webmaster or web developer and then have some editing tools that will allow me to edit the website online, like directly from the browser without going into the server access and MySQL access and all those stuff. So it helped people collaborate easily on open source online projects.
So also to edit the source within the browser?
No, you don't edit the source. We build a way where we redefine the applications as database fields. So, for example, each website can be like each piece of the website can be defined inside the database, where you can have a bar where you have the input query and the output of it and the CSS, and then you have a form where you can edit those stuff and they are stored in the database. So, what I could do is it goes to the database, read all your definition, and then it renders the website out of those definition.
And where is this software used? Do you have any big projects where it is deployed?
Our main project was OpenClipArt, and now there's the Shareism, the Creative Commons Artboard website, the Creative Commons Syria website, and there are a few commercial websites. Most of them coming from the Artboard and China and Asia. But also we are trying to release a new website called, it's not new, but release it on IKEA framework. It's Open Font Library. And yeah, John, you think any other examples?
Yeah, we have several that we're launching. We try to, hopefully, can you hear me okay?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Great. So several sites that we are launching right now and. Some big projects, and the really great thing about IKEA framework is that the software allows for websites to really be web applications. So we are working towards so where a website is deployable by other parties as well. So if you have a website that's, a blog aggregator, that other people can then deploy the same app and just change the style and a few features and have the same type of website with a different style. So that's the kind of power of iKey Framework, another power of iKey Framework.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you could really fork the whole web page with all the underlying models. Wow, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
That's powerful. Yeah. Maybe we'll just start with the fabricators. So as far as I understood it, this is a project where you do software development, but also real assembling stuff. At least I thought that. And it is a company which uses half of her time for classical business and the other half for internal projects. Is this about right? Maybe John,
yes,
you can tell.
Yes. Sure. So Fabricators has existed for years now. But really the idea, yes, is this type of open production and taking from various fields like free software, Creative Commons, open source, and doing different types of activities around that. I always like to say that we only do successful projects. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, kind of a mantra, is like we could take like five keywords, maybe one word, and do a complete total project around that with minimal involvement. So part of that is both the projects, but it's really about the people who are involved in Fabricators. And even the character used for the company is Wang, which is king in Chinese, but it's kind of a mashup of some other characters as well. But the point is that each developer is very solid and can execute most everything that the other developers can as well. So very developer centric. So we have Christopher, Basil, Barry, Brad. We have Sophie. We have several different people who are fabricators that are working on different projects around the world. We put on conferences in China. We put on events in the Middle East. But it's more than just iKey Lab, which is our company that does iKey software in Singapore. It's doing larger activities and more incubation type activities. We just put on an art event in Hong Kong, where we fabricated a sound system for an art show. So there's some type of creative projects. And right now we're working on a book spread in Berlin as part of Transmedia, the large art and culture festival connected to technology. And we're doing a book about the open web as part of this festival. So we do a lot of different activities, but it's also kind of a clearinghouse for intellectual property and software productions that we do.
Mm-hmm. So Fabricators is like the roof of everything you do, or it possibly gives you also the legal structure for what you do, because it's not even that you do a lot of different projects in various areas where usually people only focus at once. You're also doing this in a very transnational, transcultural way. I mean, when you say you're now in Berlin, but you come from the States. Basil is originally from Syria, but now in Singapore, and you're also working in China. So it is very global, everything you do. And can you give any reason for that? Is it just because you two met and then it was easy to go beyond borders, or?
Right. Well, we're basically really unfocused. No, I'm just kidding. that's a real problem with the type of activities we do. But we're very focused in on our projects, and we're focused in on. I like how. That the writer Bruce Sterling, he talks about it as like nets and jets. It's like these two enabling forces allow us to be both everywhere but nowhere at the same time. And So it's really about going places and people. We put people first. People are the root of a lot of these projects. So we like to go to where we're wanted and where the action's at, and also be able to split apart and do different things as well. Some activities like even media, some fun activities. Some activities don't even make that much sense. But for this year, we're a lot more calculated in where we're spending our energies and trying to focus in and accomplish some types of goals, but also eat too. So we there are business aspects to this that we have to keep in focus.
And how often do you meet within a year? So in face-to-face meeting, I mean.
Well, like Basil and I, we just were in Singapore together. I came here to Berlin, and now Christopher and Barry are here. So I guess it's like maybe once a month or once every 2 or 3 months, and pretty much see everyone. Probably I see people the most of connecting people together. But right now we're kind of pulling together to go to Syria like once or twice a year. We go to Singapore, Basil and I, more than other people. We've been building this project in Singapore, so probably 3, 4, 5, 6 times a year. We used to have an office in San Francisco, but that's just changed. Mm-hmm. So, but actually the U.S. is one of the harder places for us to meet. It's just actually kind of far away from the action mm-hmm. of where we're focusing, but it's still a key part. Some of our Barry is a fabricator. He lives in San Francisco. Spencer's another one. He lives in San Francisco. But Christopher lives in Taiwan and Beijing. Sophie lives in Beijing. Basil, Syria, Singapore. I live on an airplane. So we try to get together, but we do some things like weekly calls that we try to keep our weekly call going all the time, depending on our time zone. But we do some things like that and using online systems to really manage our project. We also have an IG channel where we keep communicating about things, and, of course, email works.
Mm-hmm. The focus looks to me like it is in Middle East and Asian countries. And how is it to relate between these two? And to work between these quite not so homogeneous cultural areas of Middle East, Arabic and Asian, particularly China, Singapore, Malaysia. Is there any difference? Do you have to switch in your head, or is it the same open source, just do stuff concept everywhere?
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I don't really have to switch. I don't know. It's you get used to it, and it's kind of like sometimes it's like getting to the airport's like the most important thing, depending on how good of a time you had in different cities. There is some regularity to different cities, but like for example, like we're doing our part, we have a hackerspace in Syria, so we can always trade different types of activities for this. For people to come there. Language, English, Chinese, these things are becoming more and more used for all of us. I mean, I'm American. A few of us are American on the team. So we're trying to get more like doing Arabic and trying to do Chinese. And so it's pretty important to change it up and to adapt. But Basil, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think also it's a concept where we met, like we most of us met online first time, right? So we live online, like, so it doesn't matter where one is, as long as we are working together. So we just like, we throw an event like in China or Hong Kong, and then the next week, everyone is in different country, and then in a month we meet again. So it's more of like a cultural side, like where we believe that all the blessings are equal or the blessings are the same, just like as long as we are doing the right work with the right people and the cool communities are around the world.
Maybe come back to Syria now. Can you tell me more about your hackerspace there? When did you fund it? How many people you have? Which furniture or machines do you own?
It was started a year ago, and almost like 9 months, 10 months. And there are 70 people who are involved in the hackerspace. There, we don't have membership system, so it's open to anyone. It's free, just like we are encouraging the culture. So, and there are like the core team is like 15 people, where like the people who you can access anytime. Basically, we don't have furniture. Like, we like to really assemble stuff. We are a bit minimalist. Like, we don't like to have like too many stuff, which is like give like more of big space to everyone. There are chairs and tables, and that's it. We have we worked on teaching people how to use electronics. So we have electronics materials and components. We also use our own controllers that were made by basically a project started with John and other non-fabricators members, and it's called the NanoNote. So it's Qi hardware, open hardware, which is manufactured in China and distributed globally. So we teach people how to use it and how like to build circuits and stuff using these microcontrollers. And the other part is to do social activities where, like, people gather and talk, like, about their work. So we encourage them, like, to talk about their media projects, their companies, whatever they want to know to do. We have a pretty fast internet connection. Like, it was really bad 6 months ago, and now we had a better connection. And, yeah, that's about it in the hackerspace, I think.
Maybe you can tell us something. What's the relationship between Ekilab and the Syrian society? Do you have, I don't know, do you teach classes? Do you have any connections to NGOs or government? Or is there a technology industry in Syria? Is it looking at you? How can one imagine this?
Basically, there are no, like, the NGOs are only European that are allowed to work in Syria. So basically, it's really hard to create an NGO in Syria. So even IKEALB is now getting the license to be an NGO, but it's a bit tricky. Our main community comes from the Information Technology University in Damascus. And there are other people coming from different sectors in the information technology. Also, we are connected to the fine art, the Faculty of Fine Art in Damascus University. So we do art projects like photography workshops. There's our contributor, Ahmad Ali, who like does like weekly classes for artists about different aspects, including photograph, fine art, and those stuff. Mm-hmm. And but basically, we are not affiliated with any local organizations in Syria. Like, everyone is free to come to do whatever they want, but there is no official relationship with the universities or stuff.
Maybe open it up to the wider public. I mean, we recently had this revolution in Tunisia, where the government, which was seen as a very stable one from many Western observers, was destroyed, and the president fled to Saudi Arabia. And now people try to analyze and find out what happened there. And some commentators say that social media played a big role in these events, and that especially Twitter and Facebook empowered these people to connect, to share information, and at the end to organize this protest. And the recent rumors have been that now many countries start thinking about what could be the outcome of this social media, and especially in the Arabic world, the theories go quite wide. And so I wanted to ask what your opinion is on that, what you think that the social media could do, and where is it least used in Syria or in the rest of the Arabic world right now?
Well, interesting question. So first, I think it's the people of Tunisia, right? So we have to respect the decision that was made and executed by the Tunisian people. And it's one of the first times in the last 50 or 60 years in the Arab world that the people can gather and make a decision and, like, we don't want a government, we want a new one, and then execute it. It happened in Lebanon earlier, but was less violent. And I totally respect the people of Tunisia and their ability to make a choice. I think the Twitter and Facebook and those social media were a helpful tool for people to connect and spread the word, but it's not enough to make any change in any country unless the people have the enough education and enough will to build their lives. Many people, died of this. I'm really sorry, like, about the people who put their lives on danger just to make a change in their countries. So I think it's much more complicated than that, such social media. It's for the sake of life of people who died in there. It's not just Twitter. It's not enough to have Twitter and Facebook.
Definitely.
People have put their life, and that's something we totally should respect. And I think it's not like always like it's not helpful to. For other countries, like, who's thinking, like, hey, well, Twitter was a tool that helped a revolution to start, so we have to block Twitter. I think it's more about the people. If people want to meet, and many revolutions happened before the internet, like in 50 years in Syria and other countries, and there was, like, no Twitter. People were gathering in clubs, they have mail, and they have all those stuff. So maybe the social media would help, but it's, like, I would give it like 2% of the whole operation.
This is John here. Another thing is just that the good thing, one of the things about the social media that you find when you're traveling then is people might, you know, they change their avatar to be green. They feel like they can participate in this process. It might even be somewhat superficial in some ways, but people feel that they can help out even if they're from outside of the country. And that's one of the things. But yeah, I think it's like Basil was saying, it's very important to remember that these are real people's lives. Like for example, Basil has family, you know, everything in Syria, and we care about Basil and his family. But there's lots of people who live in the Arab world as well. And it's not just like clicking on buttons or making radical statements that we can make. It's more important than that. It's down to the individual people on the street and living there.
I didn't want to reduce it in any way. It's just about the function of communication in general. It doesn't matter if it is a book, print, or some form of electronic medium, but communication between citizens is the most powerful tool which you can give to people. What they then do with that is completely up to the people, and I agree, of course, that this is a very complex matter, and historians will need a long time to really find out what happened there, because it was also the Tunisian thing which just happened was completely unpredicted. It was seen as a very stable country, and then it had this radical fast shift. And at least from the outside, it was very hard to forecast. But maybe, John, one issue that came up to my mind, and which is technology related. We often hear Facebook and Twitter in this discussion, and these are both two big American companies, and at least for Twitter, there is an alternative with Identica. And I was wondering if you could tell us also about of the experience you maybe know about from the Iranian Revolution. How bulletproof is the identikit technology when it comes to censorship or going beyond big firewalls and stuff like that?
Right. So the Identica runs the software status.net or StatusNet, and the StatusNet software, or it's a server, we call it the StatusNet server, is built in a way that allows for a distributed architecture, allows for different sites to be running on different servers or instances, and they can communicate. This is important because in a centralized network, services such as Twitter and Facebook are both very easily blockable and filterable, and there is a one path to getting access to this type of software. Now, both Facebook and Twitter have many, many, many millions and millions of users now, so it's very, very, I don't know, it's the choice selection if you want to maximize your broadcast capability around the world. But it's also in China, for example, Facebook is blocked. Twitter is sometimes randomly blocked and or filtered. The same way in Arab world, there's several countries that filter and or block this account. We saw Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook just made a trip to China over the holidays. And essentially it was to try to understand and try to get Facebook unblocked in China. This is pretty interesting because if the technology is built in a certain way, it could be resistant to this, and or people could install that software just as easily as they install WordPress on a blog. They could install a StatusNet server and be able to use that anywhere. Mm-hmm. So that's the real thing. We have to think about this type of architecture and how that allows for communication and service.
Yeah, you can see it now with file sharing and torrent protocol that decentralized versions are much more stable when it comes to attack vectors. But I don't know.
But we also see, like, I mean, to bring up like WikiLeaks or something like that, it's like we can also see like some architecture here in Berlin. We've been talking about this a bit. It's the cloud computing, and it's kind of the fallacy of cloud computing is that it's vaporous, right? It's really actually centralized network. There's lots of server farms with single endpoints. It appears like it's like many, many computers that are spread out. Oh, it's all over the place. It's everywhere, but it's actually not. And not only that, it's dependent upon the legal jurisdiction that the servers are actually in.
Exactly. I don't know.
Basically pushing technology companies to kick out WikiLeaks off the servers and or supporting it. So that's another thing.
Let's go back to the usage of social media. Can you give us a picture when it comes to young people? How do they use social media? The youth in Syria, for example. Just give us some picture, because I think many people don't have an accurate one.
Well, first of all, Facebook is blocked in Syria, right? But it's not blocked in a sense that it's not allowed to use. Like, it's technically blocked, but everyone is using Facebook. All the young people have Facebook accounts, and the government is okay with that.
Ah, right? Okay. And how does it work when it's blocked?
Well, people use different tools like proxy tools. They use Tor projects or like SSH tunnels, many different ways to overcome the blockage of the website. But like, for example, on internet cafes, like if you go to an internet cafe in Syria, Facebook will automatically work because they have like a special software or called Tor they run, and it makes it overcomes the proxy. And also there are some new news now that I just heard like 2 days ago, where I was still in Singapore, that now the chat applications are blocked. The eBuddy chat client is blocked, and maybe the Opera Mini web browser is also blocked. So if you have, because users on mobile used to have Opera Mini, which connects to Opera server, and make a tunnel. And then now everyone's talking about like Opera doesn't work anymore. You have it installed, but you can't open any website on it. So yeah, there's big effort put by the Australian government to monitor the internet and to block those websites. And sometimes they give some reasons, like some reasons that, like the reason was they said like we blocked eBuddy because it's taking too much time of people. And literally, and then like later, the telecom company Siriatel released their own chat client. So chat, I still don't know, is chat good or bad for Syrian people? Right? So yeah, but people will still, well, I'm pretty sure people will find a way around this and always use the chat clients and Facebook to connect with friends. And I don't see any danger of using it, especially in Syria, where most people believe in their government and they support it, right? Mm. So they just use it to share photos and like do the and share information about technology and other stuff.
But I find it amazing that you have anonymization software like Tor running by default on internet cafes. This sounds strange to me in a way. But it's a good direction, don't get me wrong.
I know, but I mean, for internet cafes, so people, it's now becoming more easy to get internet connection in Syria. But it's not that easy to for many people to open Facebook from their homes. So they go to internet cafes where the default expected thing that Facebook and other chat clients will just work there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big part of the internet cafes business, is that you have fast connection with everything open.
Mm.
But internet cafes still has to collect the data from users. So there's a policy where internet cafes has to install a special software that monitors whatever everyone is doing and then give a full dump of the log to Secret Service. I think we probably have to cut part of this later. Yeah.
Okay. We just make a beep over this.
Beep.
Okay. So the internet cafes, they probably are also a place where you go when you need help for your computer and when you are searching for new software or stuff like that. Yeah, we just lost Basil, and sadly, it looks like he can't come back online, which is really sad, because I really would have liked to continue this discussion.
Yeah.
But John is still here, as you can hear, and John, at least to you, I can thank you for this great discussion, and anything else? Anything last you want to say? You want to make some advertisement for the reason you are in Berlin right now? Or
advertisements. I thought, don't we have Adblocker on? I mean, we're just going to keep working on IKEA Lab, IKEA Fabricators this year. And this year, it's a pretty good year for us to do a lot more calculated type efforts. And we have a pretty good team. Everything's looking really good there. Hope Basil just popped back online.
Here he is.
But we want to keep working on things and appreciate this interview and everything and appreciate your time as well on editing it and posting it up.
Yeah, I thank you, and maybe we can get Basil back on for saying thank you.
Maybe you can ping him in a second or something, and he'll get back to you. He's probably trying furiously to get on back on right now. So,
okay, good. Maybe we can catch him later. But I thank you for the discussion, and I hope you do well for all your projects. And if there's anything new, keep us updated. And
sure. Well, like I said, you're welcome to come to Syria. Welcome to come to Singapore. Come to China too. We want to have a space in China sometime here. But look forward to people to come to our spaces and work together on things. So
that's
future is bright.
Totally awesome. Okay, thank you. That's what for today for Talking Anthropology. I say goodbye to the audience and come back to you in a month on signalhackerspaces.org.
Cheers. Bye.
Please dial *611 for assistance.
We get signal, main screen turn on. You're listening to the radio program about hackerspaces.